Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. I don't know where that lady is. She's supposed to be talking, but she's not. So I'll talk. This is Patrick Madrid. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. My number is 888-914-9149.
Your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny.
Again? I specifically asked for no misogyny this time. I'll have pickles, tomato, lettuce, onion, cheese. Hold the misogyny. Save it for Cyrus.
Right. Yeah, we can't go down that road
Save
again.
Save it for Cyrus.
I'm sorry.
Tom Hanks has a son. His name is Chet. He's the lesser known son, I think, because his other brother, Colin Hanks, is an actor. You've probably seen him in some
things. That's a son.
Yeah,
oh, Colin Hanks. That's what you said. No, all right. Stepping away. Mm-hmm.
Step away from the microphone. I thought this was interesting. It just kind of caught my eye. Everybody knows who Tom Hanks is. I like his acting an awful lot. I've seen most of his movies. I like him. But I thought this was kind of counterintuitive. Tom Hanks' son, Chet Hanks, claimed on Tuesday that despite growing up with an Oscar-winning dad, he had no one to turn to as a celebrity kid. So this was him. I mean, this is not like secret information. He himself talked about this. He says, I didn't have a strong male role model. He says, I didn't have a strong male role model to tell me, bro. I can't say what he says because he uses a lot of bad words, but bro, like, forget about these people. I'm modifying. They're just jealous of you. He's 31. He said this in a video on his YouTube channel of the disrespect that he endured from peers because of his wealth and fame and being perceived as arrogant, entitled, and spoiled. He says, you have all these things that they want, so they're trying to figure out how to throw their shade at you. So you can feel bad about yourself because they're jealous. I needed to hear that, he said. I didn't have anyone to tell me that. This is me now telling the younger version of myself what I needed to hear then. He's a rapper. Maybe that's why he talks the way he talks.
Guys, there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball!
That was one of his least good movies.
Houston, we have a problem.
That was one of his best movies.
It's a household name.
That's probably his best movie. So Chet Hanks says, it was extremely hard to break down their walls. So I encountered a lot of disdain, a lot of animosity and negativity because everybody was just prepared to hate my guts. Chet, who regularly posts photos of himself flexing his muscles on Instagram, added that due to his hard exterior and ability to intimidate, many of his haters never had the nerve to confront him face to face. He said, people kind of did mess with me a lot growing up, but it was never to my face. It was always behind my back in the form of gossip and talking. He says he understands that growing up with privilege can result in resentment from those who are not as fortunate. He says there's a lot of advantages, but sometimes it can be pretty weird. I got to do a lot of cool things that a lot of people don't get the opportunity to do. I got to travel the world, stay in nice hotels, fly on private planes, and I'm very blessed for that. I wouldn't change my situation. My experience was even more complicated because on top of fame already being toxic, I wasn't even famous. He says, I was just the son of somebody famous. So I hadn't even done anything to deserve any sort of recognition, and that created a lot of contempt. That's just interesting. And I the reason I say it's counterintuitive is because I would assume, and I'd like to think that Tom Hanks would be kind of a cool father figure. You know, if he's at least anything like his characters tend to be on in the movies, and I realize that's sometimes, you know, very far from the truth, but it makes me wonder about the effects of vast amounts of wealth and have everything at your fingertips, the private jets, etc., for somebody who, like him, who didn't do anything to earn that. I mean, it can be toxic enough for the people who did earn it, but for the hangers-on, or in his case, he's just a family member. It's not his fault. You know, he's the son. He's part of the family. But what would it be like to grow up in that world? I imagine to myself, what would it be like to have all these things at my fingertips and then people resent you for it? It's not your fault, but they still resent you. I don't know. Just something to think about.
Important. That's all I have to say about that.
Good father figures are important. Would you agree with me, Cyrus?
Yeah, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. They are pretty important.
I would say so. And your kids are lucky. They have a good father in you. I don't interpret this stuff that he's saying in a negative light on Tom Hanks, because I don't know anything about it. I mean, he may be as, you know, who knows is what I'm saying.
This guy seems like he spends a lot of time on social media, a lot. Yeah. And in fact, I think that's what his income is he's a social influencer, whatever that is. And so he's talking about all of the naysayers online. And I don't know the guy, but seems like he lives online. And I was listening to Blow Jogan on Potsify.
No, I have no idea who that is. Mo Jogan.
Oh, Mojo, yeah.
A fictitious, non-existent personality on the fictitious, non-existent platform called Potsify.
That's right. And he said something that was really interesting about social media. And he's like, you know what? I stopped looking at it and all of it went away. Because it only exists in this imaginary landscape of social media. So you ignore it and it's not there. It's not a part of my life.
Yes, that's true.
So
I'll give you an example. Every so often, you know, somebody will rear up on his hind legs and attack me publicly. You know, typically it would be on social media or something like that. I just ignore it. And I don't read it. You know, if I become aware of it, or people are texting me breathlessly, did you see what so and so said about you? Did you see the video that so and so? And my reaction is, you know, he takes me a lot more seriously than I take him. And I'm just not going to pollute my life by worrying about what people are saying online. I personally don't care. And I think that's where people really get messed up, is if they can't tear themselves away from it and they start taking these pot shots personally, you know, especially when it's coming from whoever it may be who's just doing it to get clicks or just doing it to get, you know, his or her own public adulation. I suppose that's a motivator for some people. But that's my philosophy. You take me way more seriously than I take you. And I just don't care. I don't care what you think. Doesn't matter to me one little bit.
That reminds me of an old Neil Young lyric. Doesn't mean that much to me to mean that much to you.
I don't know that song, but it sounds like a breakup song.
It's Old Man.
Oh, yeah, you're right. What am I thinking? And a man of my age, you know, maybe I should take that more seriously. All right, let's get back to the phone calls. How about Bunny in St. Louis, Missouri? Hi, Bunny. Hello, Bunny.
Hi, Patrick. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome.
You're
on the air. What would you like to talk about, Bunny?
Okay. I have a friend, and she's a very good Catholic. She's in our Bible group, and she has an adult son. And she just mentioned the other day that she was accompanying him to different churches because he's trying to pick one because he's not happy with the Catholic Church or doesn't get anything out of it. And I was just wondering, I was kind of startled. I didn't know how to respond to her. And I'm wondering, is that something you would recommend for her to do or not?
Absolutely not. No. Because although I could understand, and not that I would agree with, but I could understand and I could even sympathize with the young man who's looking for God, That's a human aspiration that we can understand and we can encourage, but I certainly wouldn't encourage his mother to lead him astray intentionally, because if she's leading him around or going with him to these other churches, whatever they may be, it's a form of religious indifferentism, which is a heresy. To say, or in this case, it's more of an attitude that it doesn't really matter which church you belong to because they're all more or less the same, and we all believe more or less in the quote-unquote essentials, even though there is no such list. It's a form of religious indifferentism. And so if she's reinforcing this already erroneous notion in his mind that it's a good thing to search for the church that suits you best, she's actually causing more harm, and she's not causing anything good. She's causing more harm. So if I were her, or if I were his dad, I would be gently and lovingly and compassionately trying to speak to him and work with him so that he would see that the very church that he's walking away from is the church that he's actually looking for. He just doesn't realize it yet. And that Jesus is present in his church, in the Catholic Church, and specifically in the sacraments, in a way far more real and far more powerful and life-changing than anything he would ever find in any other church. I would be trying to help him see that. I would definitely not be taking him around to different churches so he could sample the flavors.
Okay. That's kind of what I started to say, but in our little group, it's amazing to me how I think, even like I said, in a little Catholic Bible study group, so many people, I think, really believe that, you know, I mean, I guess they think that our religion, they know our religion is, you know, the true religion, but everybody's going to heaven. It doesn't matter what church you belong to. And I am not one to sit there and say, no, that's not the case. But I did kind of challenge her a little bit on it that, you know, I've heard you say and others so many times that it's not what you really get out of Mass. You know, it's what you're giving back to God also. But right. I didn't want to say a lot in front of other people, but I certainly didn't think that it was good of her. And her hopes is that he will do exactly what you said, realize the Catholic Church is the true church. Mm-hmm. But it just seems strange to me that she would go with him. And she's real nice, you know, just, you know, unlike me, just one of these real nice people. And, you know, kind of like, okay, honey, I'll, you know, we'll go and we'll try this one out. We'll try this one out and, you know, whatever. And I just didn't really know if I should say anything to her next week or just let it go.
I think that if you're her friend and you can gently give her some encouragement to do what's right, I think that would be helpful. And she would probably thank you for it. Maybe she's just doing the best she can because it's all she can think of. She doesn't really know what else to do. And so your second opinion might be very helpful for her. It strikes me like this.
Okay.
Imagine if, and it's not an exact analogy, it's, you know, there is an apples and oranges effect here, but there is a parallel that I find interesting because there are a few things in life. In fact, I would argue in a certain sense, the most important thing in life is your relationship with Almighty God. That to me is fundamental. So if I can use this comparison, Bunny, it would be as if, you know, her son was married and he was unhappy with his marriage and he just wasn't like, you know, super in love with his wife anymore. And his mom said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you and I go around and we'll just visit with a bunch of different women. And, you know, maybe you'll find another woman that you like more and maybe you can go and hang out with her instead of with your wife. It would be terrible to do that. And, of course, it would be his mother's way of condoning without maybe, you know, in that extreme situation, she would realize it. It would be condoning parting from your lawfully wedded wife. And no good mother or father would do that. I'm not saying she's not a good mother. I'm sure she's a good mother. I'm sure she's a good woman. But the analogy, I think, is interesting because in the same way, to help to lead somebody away from the church that Jesus established, the Catholic Church, to my mind, would be tantamount to leading, you know, one's son away from his wife in search of a better or prettier wife. Kind of strikes me the same way.
Okay. Yeah, because like I say, it was kind of interesting at the table. Most everybody was like, oh, that's really good that he still wants to, you know, belong to a church or worship God. I think everybody was like, you know, more or less condoning what she's doing.
That's
you know,
bad.
The fact that the young man wants to do that.
Yeah, that's really too bad. And I'm so glad, Bunny, that you are, you know, that you have your wits about you and that for you, you see that this is a problem because God may be wanting to use you to help guide this situation in a better direction.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe I'll say something next week.
Okay. You got it. Thanks, Bunny. You know, that's one reason, everybody, why I wrote a book called Why Be Catholic. I wrote this book published by Random House, and the subtitle is 10 Answers to a Very Important Question, because over the years, I have encountered countless people, just like the young man in question here, and many others, who genuinely, they just don't, it just doesn't click for them. And they're in the Catholic Church, maybe raised in the church, maybe they went to Catholic school, and it just doesn't click. And so they go in search of the Lord, not realizing that they're walking away from where he is. And they're searching for him and not knowing how to find him. And so when I sat down and wrote that particular book, it was with that person in mind. In other words, what would I say to that young man if I had a chance to talk to him and lay out the case for the Catholic Church? That's what that book is. So in your own experience with people, young people, older people, people leave the church at all kinds of different ages, but I think very often it's because there's nobody in his or her life who will take the time to sit down and help them and talk with them. And maybe it might require many talks, many conversations. I remember when I was a young adult, so I was already married with a few kids, my mid-20s, I guess it was. And my younger sister, I'm the oldest, so my next youngest sister, she was going out with a guy who went to Calvary Chapel. Now, if you're not familiar with Calvary Chapel, it's a fast-growing denomination that kind of styles itself as a non-denominational. It's a non-denominational denomination. And it was started in Costa Mesa in the 1960s during the height of the Jesus People movement. And it became very popular and it has spread. So they have many different locations, certainly all around Southern California, but they've even branched into other parts of the country. And generally, Calvary Chapel is extremely anti-Catholic, extremely anti-Catholic. And it's not uncommon for Calvary Chapel ministers to be former Catholics. But in any case, the guy that my sister was going out with was a member of Calvary Chapel. And so he was a nice guy. He was, you know, fun to be around, I guess. But he was working on my sister, trying to get her to leave the Catholic Church. And he was rather successful, but he wasn't entirely successful. But she never actually did leave the church. But I'll tell you what happened. It got to the point, because he was sort of, you know, nibbling, and telling my sister all these things, why she shouldn't be Catholic and she should go to Calvary Chapel. And she was swayed enough that she told my dad about it. Now, my dad didn't get angry. He didn't pound his fist on the table. He didn't say, you should stay away from that guy. He didn't say any of those things. What he did was he said, let's talk about it. So my sister sat down, and in one of those conversations, because there were several, I was involved more as just a sort of a bystander. I was there watching it. I wasn't really participating very much because my dad was doing a great job of answering her questions. She said, well, what about, why do we worship Mary? Well, we don't worship Mary, you know, and giving her the explanation. So in a subsequent conversation, because I think she was feeling like, yeah, that's right, I forgot about that. And she was starting to get, you know, kind of tilting back in the direction of the Catholic Church. And I forget now whether the boyfriend said, I want to be there at the next conversation or not, or maybe my dad invited him. But anyway, in one of these conversations, he was there and he tried to, he tried to make the case. I'm laughing only because I remember how badly it went for him. And my dad didn't get angry. And he wasn't rude in any way at all. But man, he just, like bowling pins, this guy would set up his arguments and my dad would just knock them down with a smile on his face with the Bible. And my sister saw that. And she basically said, you know what? I need to be a Catholic. I am a Catholic and I'm going to stay Catholic. And no, thank you very much. I'm not going to go to Calvary Chapel. And as I recall, that's when their relationship ended, happily, because, I mean, you know, there's nothing left there. And he was not successful in convincing her to leave. And my dad did what I'm advocating, and that is he took the time necessary even though it was at times maybe a little bit tense, or there's the possibility of conflict or all those things, but he just handled it very smoothly over the course of a few different conversations, and he reeled my sister back in. And she's been a lifelong faithful Catholic before and after that point. She never left the church, but she might have. She probably would have had it not been for what my dad did. So that's what I'm advocating for all of you, is do that. Take the time. Be available. Learn the faith so that you can hand it on. You can't give what you don't have, obviously. But there will be times when you will be called upon to sacrifice to help preserve and salvage, save somebody's faith. Don't let that opportunity pass. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Thank you again for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I just want to remind you about this brand new set of Lenten Reflections by Father Rocky. They're video-based. They're on the Mass, and they're absolutely free. If you would like to get yours starting Ash Wednesday and going all the way through to Easter Sunday to help you gain a deeper understanding and a deeper love for the Mass, just go to relevantradio.com/Lent and you can sign up. There's no obligation, no strings attached, absolutely free. All you need to do is tell us where to email it and we will. Go to relevantradio.com/Lent. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go first to John in Florida. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Patrick. Good morning to you and good morning to Cyrus.
Indeed.
You did a great job, Patrick, and you really explain things clearly about our Catholic faith, and you give us ways for us to defend our Catholic faith. And
thank you for that. Thank you kindly.
The reason I'm calling is about this baptism thing. You mentioned about the priest, it was a week or two ago, that saw a video of his baptism and realized he was not properly or validly baptized.
Right.
Now, I'm 72. My baptism was like 72 years ago. There were no videos that I can look at.
Right.
And I got a baptismal certificate saying I'm baptized. I always assumed I'm baptized. But I'm a little concerned now. How do I know if the priest that baptized me used the proper words or not? And
well,
I try to go Mass every day, receive communion, but is that all useless or invalid?
No. So let me put your mind at ease. First of all, 72 years ago was, what, 1950? So,
yes, sir.
Yeah, so in 1950, there did not exist in the way that we know it today a variation from one parish to another in terms of how Mass was celebrated or how the sacraments were administered or how the faith was taught. It was very, very consistent from one parish to another. Now, at the Second Vatican Council, things changed dramatically, and it could no longer be said that the way it once was, at least in terms of the consistency from parish to parish, that was no longer the case. And sometimes you found yourself saying, well, you know, can you recommend a good parish for me, a parish where they're, you know, they're more faithful or more Catholic. Generally, you didn't have that kind of an issue in 1950. So for that reason, even just that reason alone, I have absolute moral certitude that you were baptized validly, because an example of a priest baptizing invalidly would be so out of the norm and so noticeable that people would have taken notice of it. They would have taken notice of it. It would have been so... what's the word I want here? It would have been so egregious that it would have been much more noticeable. Now, these days, when you have all kinds of, I hate to say it this way, but it's true, You have all kinds of deficiencies to greater or lesser degrees in priestly training. And you also have, in the case of some religious orders, not to mention in some diocesan settings as well, you've got priests who just take it upon themselves to freelance. And they're just going to do it their way. And they don't care what the church teaches. Thankfully, it's a small minority of priests, but there are some who do that. And they don't necessarily even fully believe everything that the church teaches. We've seen this. So for that reason, nowadays, there's far more variation, and that makes it less easy to see it when you see it. But in 1950, boy, would that have stuck out like a sore thumb. So the parish priest at your parish, I am absolutely certain, baptized you with the proper form and matter. For that matter, your parents were there most likely, and your godparents were there, and presumably even other people may have been there as well. And so they all saw this happen, and it was duly recorded in the church's files, and you have a baptismal certificate. So you have no reason whatsoever to be concerned about the validity of your baptism, nor about the subsequent sacraments that you received. You can rest easy, John. Oh, I'm absolutely certain.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you, Patrick. But now that really calms me down. But what about people that were baptized after Vatican II, and there's more priests deviating from the norm?
Yep.
Do they need to get rebaptized? Or?
Well, in the case of somebody who has certain knowledge that the baptism was invalid, yes. And it's not rebaptism in the sense that you can't repeat baptism. They would need to get validly baptized because the first attempt was not valid in their case. So it is an unfortunate truth. It's a very painful situation for many people because if they have reason to believe that their baptism was invalid. Now, it's not just like a hunch or I wonder if maybe the priest didn't. That's no reason to worry. The only time there would be a reason to worry is in the case in Phoenix, when the diocese sends out an all points bulletin saying this particular priest baptized invalidly for 20 plus years, and here are the different churches that he served in. And if you were a member of any of these parishes, you had your kids baptized or anything like that, you need to come in so we can baptize you validly, baptize your children validly, and then the other sacraments as well. So it's a big process. There's a whole new outreach now that's taking place to help people, first of all, to locate them, and then to help them so that they can receive the sacraments validly. So it's a real problem. It's not just nitpicking or hair splitting. It's a real problem. But thankfully, as far as I can tell, this kind of thing is not widespread. It has happened. We've seen, as you brought up, the incident of two young men who were ordained to the priesthood, two separate incidents. And one, apparently he was like just watching the VHS cassette of his own baptism. Now, he had been ordained a priest, even though he hadn't been because it wasn't valid. But as he's watching his own baptism, he's watching how the deacon, in that case, invalidly baptized him. So he's realizing to his horror, as he's watching the videotape, probably in his parents' living room, I was not validly baptized. Now, of course, the cascading effect would mean if I wasn't validly baptized, I was not validly confirmed, nor was I validly ordained to the priesthood. So once, you know, he brought this to his bishop, he said, look at this. So the bishop, you're absolutely right. So he received all of his sacraments from baptism forward. He was ordained a priest, even though he had been in ministry for a year. That's how serious this is. So thankfully, on the one hand, we're not faced with what appears to me to be in any way any kind of a widespread problem. I think people should breathe easily and trust in the church's training of priests that they would baptize correctly. And in the case where there is some reason to doubt it, then you would take action. Then you would go to your parish priest and say, I have reason to believe that my baptism was invalid. And then he will help you sort that out. So I hope that's all helpful to you, John. And perhaps other people have the same concern. And I hope that I can allay that concern. We don't want people lying awake, sleepless at night, worrying about this if there's no reason to do so. Let's go to Carolina in Bluffton, South Carolina. Is it Carolina or Carolina?
Oh, Carolina, actually. Thank you.
Carolina. Welcome.
Most people mispronounce it. So. Thank you for taking my call. I just recently found you, and it's been such a great help to listen to you. I'm a cradle Catholic, but I left the church for over 25 years, actually, but just recently returned. And for
Welcome
me,
home.
Like the rigidity, thank you. I've been learning so much and really relearning everything. It's been a blessing, but I wanted to mention just like for me personally, the rigidity and the impersonal approach of those in the church during my formation mm-hmm. was a big part of me leaving. And I simply didn't trust that these people cared for me at all as a person. And as a young person seeking, you know, the true love of God, this was a huge evidence to me that at the time anyway, that I didn't feel like it was a true church, right? It didn't seem, these people didn't seem to exemplify what Jesus taught. So it was more like rules and rigidity over love for the person and walking with them, you know, et cetera. So there's this kind of sense of distrust, you know, that I had certainly. And I think a lot of people come at some point, you know, a lot of Catholics do find themselves in that position and then they leave the church. And that's what happened to me. And I do feel that there's like, idea of invalid baptisms will only create more mistrust. So my question is, I know you've talked a lot about it and you've done a great job of explaining why it's invalid and then the mercy of God, which I think we all believe in and to be true, right? Mm-hmm. But you touched upon it a little bit, but I feel like, you know, especially those perhaps in my position, my kids are 18 and 16 now, and because of what I went through, I didn't baptize them. And they have just chosen recently to be baptized and enter the church, and they will be going through their initiation sacraments this Easter. And I'm so happy beyond, you know, description of that this is happening to them. But, you know, this whole idea of invalid baptisms, I'm like, whoa. And I feel like one of the things that hasn't been addressed too much is like the competence, right, and the trust that we have in the church as the representative of Christ here on earth. And what responsibility does the church have to make amends for these people who are probably not like sleeping well at night because of this? And I know that your words are, you know, are very comforting because, you know, you're knowledgeable and I think you're right. But it doesn't necessarily take away people's anxiety that perhaps they, you know, if we truly believe in the spiritual miracles that occur in the sacraments, you know, whether someone is aware of them or not, like, if we truly believe that's true and the Catholic Church is a representative of Christ here on earth, like, they have a responsibility to repair this and to like publicly say this, right? And also I feel, what is the responsibility of the church to make sure it doesn't happen again? And like you mentioned in the previous caller, like especially in this country, it feels like a lot of parishes and some priests, not all, but you know, are kind of taking it upon themselves to do their own thing, and it's like almost the teachings of the church are being watered down. And now as I'm coming back to the church, I'm relearning everything, and it's been such a blessing to me to really go back to the traditions and the old teachings and the original teachings, right? And that has been life-saving for me. And I feel like, you know, what a disservice is happening. And I guess my question is, what do you think the Catholic Church, in terms of competence and trust that the people have in the church as a representative, what do you think it should do? And, you know,
I think I understand.
Actively reaching out to individuals who are affected, but also, like, you know, there is this thing of conditional baptism. Like, what if it has happened more widespread than we think? Like, and just as a matter of trust, so that people trust the church, what do you think would be a good thing for the church to do publicly?
Okay. I think that what is being done in Phoenix, Bishop Olmsted is the bishop there, and from everything I can see, I actually was just in Phoenix for a couple of weeks, and so I had a chance to talk to some of the priests of the diocese and kind of get a feel for what was going on. But I think that what is happening there is a good example of how it should happen. Number one, that when this problem was made known, it was made known publicly. So the church did not keep it under wraps. It didn't try to hush-hush anything. It brought it out into the light and said, we have a problem. Here's the problem. You know, the point is not to condemn anybody, but just to say that because of this defective formula of baptism, not only are there who knows how many people who are not validly baptized, but also the other sacraments that they received are also invalid. And there's a real pastoral outreach underway right now to help find those people and help them receive the sacraments. That's the first order of business, if you ask me, and that's what they're doing in Phoenix. Now, I have no say whatsoever in how that's being handled over there, but if I were a bishop, in addition to the things that are being done, and perhaps this already was done in Phoenix, I don't know if that's the case, but I would, if I were a bishop, I would write a brief letter to my people, and I'd make sure everybody heard it. I'd have it read at Mass. I would have it posted or emailed. I would make sure everybody had an opportunity to know this. And I would, as the bishop, I would say, I personally commit publicly to all of you that we will do everything necessary to provide the best and the most comprehensive and accurate preparation and training for our deacons and our priests so that this problem would never happen again, and that we will redouble our efforts so that you don't have to be like Carolina in Bluffton, South Carolina, worrying, you know, or people who are lying awake at night wondering, is my baptism valid? So I think that would be another very helpful thing to do. It would be a very pastoral thing to do if the bishop, and this could be done certainly by pastors, but the bishop has the responsibility for the training of the deacons and the priests in the diocese. And so that gets into the seminary issue and sacramental theology and pastoral theology and all the things that go into that, the church's law. I mean, it's a multifaceted issue. But personally, Carolina, I think if every bishop were to make a statement like that, and publicly commit to make to, so the people know the bishop is aware of this, the priests are aware of this, the deacons are aware of this, and they're really, really going to make sure that everybody is properly trained and that the sacraments are administered faithfully and correctly without any freelancing. That's a big problem, is when a deacon or a priest starts to freelance, that's when things go off the rails. As we've seen with this very example. He just thought, well, I think it would be better if I said, we baptize you, because maybe people will feel nicer or warm and fuzzy about this or feel like they're part of the community. All of it, of course, is wrong. He may have had the best of intentions. I don't know. But the freelancing is what gets people into trouble. And it should stop. So that would be my humble suggestion for our bishops, would be to make this known publicly for the people to help put their minds at ease.
Well, I pray that they listen to your show, because I think for someone like me who left the church and came back, and for those who perhaps are thinking of leaving the church, like, something like this is a big deal. And I think that what you just proposed would go a long way of just feeling like, okay, someone knows what they're doing, and they're going to, you know, seek to repair this and make it, make sure that it doesn't happen again.
And you know, the thing is, and I just want to end on this happy note, they do know what they're doing. So the bishops, they are aware, and they, you know, they care deeply. They want to make sure that things are right. I guess what I'm advocating for is that message is communicated powerfully to the people. I mean, take a look at this story. This story is not going away. The mainstream media has picked it up. It's all over mainstream media. Catholics and non-Catholics alike are fascinated by the topic. You've got Catholics who are worried about it. It's greatly unsettled people. And to my mind, that demonstrates just how deep this runs and what's at stake, and how people, they find themselves with this sort of existential crisis. Oh my gosh, is my baptism valid? Now, as I say, I don't think the average person has any reason to wonder about that or worry about that. But you can't help it sometimes.
People that worry. Yeah, you can't help worrying regardless. Yeah. Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I will certainly be, you know, with my ears wide open, you know, wide open listening to how they present the baptism for my own children. Thank you very much.
You got it, Carolina. Thanks. And let's talk again one of these days. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Lots to talk about on the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. If you want to send me an email, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and you'll see a link where it says contact and you can send me an email. It comes directly to me. I'll be happy to read it. Let's go to Bonnie now in Austin, Texas. Good morning, Bonnie.
Hey, Patrick. So I have a question again about invalid baptisms, and I have a second part to my question. But those who were invalidly baptized got married in the Catholic mm-hmm. Church, divorced. Mm-hmm. They would not have to seek an annulment since their marriage was not valid, I would assume. And then if they're remarried civilly and if they got married and there was no impediment on the spouse's side, then they could just get married in the Catholic Church without going through any canonical process, right?
No. If only it were that simple. But no, for this reason. Now, of course, I would submit what I'm about to tell you to the judgment of the Church and certainly to the scrutiny of a canon lawyer. I'm not a canon lawyer, but I'm almost certain that this is what the canon lawyer would tell you. That because the Church's, what we think of as the annulment process, knowing that the Church doesn't annul valid marriages, but rather will declare that an attempt at marriage null if there's evidence that there was an impediment that would have prevented it from being valid. But this process, it's solely concerned with the validity of the marriage, not with the sacramentality of the marriage. Now, the marriage can be valid without being sacramental. So if you have an unbaptized man marrying a baptized Catholic woman, to use an example, it would be a true valid marriage, but it would not be sacramental. And so the annulment process seeks to determine what is the status of this question of validity in this particular marriage. Now, in the case of somebody who finds out, well, I was not baptized, well, then that would mean that the marriage is not sacramental, but it very well may still be valid. And for that reason, the couple or either party would need to go through this process in order to determine the validity, because that's the focus, not the question of sacramentality.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. That was not the answer I was expecting, but that's okay. Very interesting.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, thank you. All right.
Thank you, Bonnie. Yeah. And again, I submit anytime I talk about a canon law issue, of course, I submit what I have to say to the authorities in this field. But I do believe that I'm representing it to you accurately. And if there are canon lawyers out there who want to weigh in, they're certainly welcome to call 888-914-9149. Let's go to Sheila now in Florida. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Patrick. I'm so grateful for your show. Thank you.
Thank you.
My heart goes out to this priest in Phoenix, you know, the story you've been talking about.
Yeah.
So it just made me wonder. My family has endured abuse from priests. And
what kind of abuse?
molestation, lies, like my sister.
If it's molestation, sexual abuse, did you or whoever was affected by it report this to the diocese and to the police?
Oh, are you kidding? No, you didn't talk about it.
How long ago did these things happen?
It's been within the last, I'd say, 30 years.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My main question to you is, though, it's really bothering me. Because my children, we were in two different parishes at different times, and they received a Holy Eucharist, confirmation, And these priests were found later to be having affairs while they're celebrating the sacraments. And that seems to me a lot worse than this poor man who says we, when you've got priests up on the altar, they're not celibate, they're having affairs with women and having children. And it's all hush-hush. So are those sacraments valid?
Almost certainly they are, yes. And this gets to a very important question. I'm glad you raised it because we really haven't touched upon it yet. And that has to do with what does the church teach about the validity of the sacraments as related to the personal sinfulness or holiness or somewhere in the middle of the priest. Now, this is something that led to a heresy in the early church. It was known as Donatism. It was found primarily in northern Africa where St. Augustine happened to be, and thank God St. Augustine was there because he was able to do battle with this heresy. The heresy pivoted upon after a wave of Roman Roman persecution under the Emperor Diocletian. In this persecution, there were found to be deacons, priests, and in some cases bishops, who, because they feared torture and martyrdom, they gave up the books, the Holy Bible. They gave up the chalices and the sacred vessels to the Roman persecutors. They, in some cases, were willing to renounce Christ so that they wouldn't be killed. And when the persecution abated, then the people who had gone through this persecution, they turned on those clergy, and they were so furious with them because they had been betrayed, you know, and these deacons, priests, and in some cases bishops, they were cowards. And so there arose this false idea, this notion that any priest or bishop who celebrated the sacraments, who was part of that group, if they were allowed back into the church after doing penance, that their sacraments were invalid because they were personally sinful. And that's not true. That was absolutely false. And that's what St. Augustine rose up to defend. And St. Augustine's project was to show that the power of the sacraments relies solely upon Jesus Christ in the sacrament, working in the sacrament. It has the priest's sinfulness. If he's having affairs, if he's doing terrible things, whatever they may be, that in itself has no bearing on the validity of the sacrament. And so you as a Catholic can go forward to receive Holy Communion, even if you knew that this priest was a scoundrel. If he's at Mass, in his private life, I mean, if he's at Mass celebrating at the altar and all these other things are there, the validity of the form and the matter, you have no reason to be concerned whatsoever that that sacrament is invalid. So this is another dimension of the question of the priest who is using an invalid formula for baptism. I've heard nothing whatsoever negative about him or his personal life or anything like that. But in the cases of the priests that you're talking about, even if they were even worse than what you understood them to be, it in no way invalidated the sacraments. It's a terrible thing for them because they were celebrating the sacraments in the state of mortal sin, so that would be another sacrilege, but that's between them and God. But it doesn't affect the validity. And that Donatist heresy, it lingered for centuries because many Catholics didn't get the memo from St. Augustine. And maybe it's good that we repeat that memo from St. Augustine now so people are not fearful about that.
Yes, it's very disheartening because there's a member of our family that was a love child of a priest, and that priest was that priest baptized the baby, and then he was, you know, moved away out of the parish. This was years ago. Moved away out of the parish. Now, is that baptism valid?
Yes,
that
was absolutely his own child? Valid. Absolutely valid. Keep repeating this: the personal sinfulness. Or, you know, let's just say sinfulness of the priest has no effect whatsoever on the validity of the sacrament. He could be the worst sinner alive. And if he's celebrating the sacraments using the proper form and matter, and if he intends to celebrate the sacrament, it's a valid sacrament. And it's no less of a sacrament for you than it would be if St. Padre Pio celebrated it. The Holy Eucharist would not be any holier when you receive our Lord in Holy Communion. There's no extra special grace if St. Padre Pio had celebrated that Mass and you received Holy Communion from him than there would be if you received a validly celebrated host, validly consecrated host from the worst sinner priest on earth. It doesn't affect the validity of the sacrament for the person
but
receiving.
But do you see what I'm saying?
I absolutely do. That's why there was such a great controversy in the early church over this Donatist heresy, because people were saying, well, what about these priests who are doing bad things? I mean, doesn't that invalidate the sacrament? And the answer firmly and universally from the church was no. It absolutely does not invalidate the sacrament.
And, you know, like people in my family, my one sister, she got married by a judge, and then she wanted to get her marriage blessed. Well, she went to the priest. He says, no, you're going to hell because you married a Baptist. It's like priests tell you, you get all this misinformation, and I'm only Catholic because Jesus Christ founded our church. Okay, mm-hmm. That's why I'm Catholic.
I've got to run, Sheila. I can feel the pain in your voice, and I deeply empathize with you. Final thought, you or whoever was involved or suffered from the abuse of these priests, you need to report it. Report it to the police, report it to the diocese. It needs to come out into the light. So please take action on that. I know it will be difficult, but it's necessary. I'll be right back right after this. Yeah.